Good afternoon. My name is Anne Cavall, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board and volunteers, I welcome you to the BCA webinar education series. I encourage you to grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. We do have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. And also, for those connected via the webcast, you should be able to see a box to the left of the slides where you will be able to submit questions during the Q&A portion near the end of this session. This year, the BCA is making exciting new changes to expand our mission and provide more frequent breast cancer education resources that are easier to access. This year, the expanded educational programming promises to encourage, empower, and engage our community in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one, and we will be offering these throughout the year. Through a revitalized education-focused fall conference, and by increased ongoing resources on our website and social media channels that are available 24/7. If you have not done so already, please be sure to connect with us on social media. We regularly share and foster discussion on the latest news and resources in breast cancer detection, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. We also encourage you to share what you learned today using the hashtag BCEAWebinar. Looking ahead, we ask you to please also join us for our annual education conference on Saturday, October 8th. This year's conference will highlight nutrition and dietary factors that prevent and control cancer development. Featuring nationally and internationally recognized integrative medicine specialist Dr. Gregory Plotnikoff, attendees will learn how to support and maintain a healthy immune system to prevent and manage disease. Renowned local chef Brenda Langdon, owner of Spoon River, will then apply these disease-fighting strategies and offer practical advice on easy food preparation and creative, delicious, healthy recipes. Oncology expert Dr. Tafaya Haddad will also provide the latest information and treatment for breast cancer patients. And as always, this year's conference includes the opportunity to connect with valuable community resources and time to meet with others just like you on how to best navigate the daily challenges of living with breast cancer. Complete registration and information will be available very soon. And please also mark your calendar for the next webinar on August 23rd, entitled Finding Hope Through the Cancer Experience, featuring licensed social worker Brenda Hartman. This webinar will provide strategies to help cancer patients find hope and healing through the cancer experience. And I'd like to now introduce the speakers for today's webinar, Camille Scheel and Judy Erdahl.
Good afternoon.
Hi, this is Camille Scheel, and I am the author of a book called Camp Chemo, Postcards Home from Metastatic Breast Cancer. It's available everywhere, Amazon, bookstores. If it's not at your local library, you can request that they get a copy for you to check out. I've also spent a lot of time working as a scientific research reviewer, both for the Department of Defense, and recently was accepted into the Advocate in Science research program. And I'm also a Hear My Voice advocate for Living Beyond Breast Cancer, as well as I've spoken at events for Young Survivor Coalition, and also tomorrow night I'll be at Gilda's Club Twin Cities for their Red Door Readers Book Club if you would like to meet me in person. So that's me.
Judy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Judy Erdahl. I also am a consumer reviewer for the Department of Defense and also an advocate for the Living Beyond Breast Cancer Hear My Voice program. I'm also an author and have a blog called Pink is Complicated, and that's just pinkiscomplicated.org. Also, my friends and I have formed Team Judy, and we raise metastatic breast cancer research dollars for the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota. So thank you for joining us today. We're excited to have everybody here, and Camille and I are really hopeful that we can help everybody learn more. Our goals for today are to help define for you what metastatic breast cancer is and what that means. Metastatic breast cancer, you can hear it called many different things. It's sometimes called advanced breast cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, late stage breast cancer. It can also be described as terminal or incurable. Our hope for today is that Camille and I will be able to share some facts about metastatic breast cancer with you. And we also want to help give you some information and support on how we live with our metastatic breast cancer diagnosis, how we handle the fear of progression and reoccurrence, and just how we're managing to still live despite having a life-challenging illness.
The word metastatic is a little bit confusing because of the spelling. The pronunciation is metastatic. There have been many instances where I've been with media people who have a really tough time pronouncing it. And as I like to say, you can't cure it if you can't pronounce it. So do take a little bit of time to try to pronounce it yourself. And what it means is that the cancer has spread to someplace beyond the breast, and it even means beyond the lymph nodes. If you are stage 3, it may mean you have some lymph node involvement. That's not the same as metastatic. It needs to travel farther. And when metastatic breast cancer is on the move, it can go anywhere, but it tends to invade the liver, lungs, bone, and brain. Depending on where the breast cancer is, depends on what kind of treatment is needed. So my breast cancer moved from my breast into my bones, and it's very important to understand that I do not have bone cancer. I have breast cancer in my bones. So that's important because bone cancer has its own set of treatment protocols, but breast cancer that is living in the bones has a different set of treatment protocols.
As you can probably start to get a handle on, it can be really complicated. A lot of people don't realize that there are nine different subtypes of breast cancer. You can have ductal breast cancer, which is the most common kind, lobular breast cancer, which is less common. About 15 to 20% of breast cancers are lobular. Inflammatory breast cancer, which is much more harder, I think, for people to recognize, because I think all of us know very well how to look for symptoms of finding a lump in our breast, but we don't so readily recognize the symptoms of inflammatory breast cancer, which can be a dimpling on your breast, some redness, or even just a very small indentation happening somewhere in your skin around or even directly under your breast tissue, and also some discharges or changing in your nipple. Also, breast cancer is then treated depending on its hormonal subtype. There's estrogen-positive breast cancer, progesterone-positive or negative breast cancer, and then HER2 breast cancer, which stands for the human epidermal growth factor and its receptor 2. And this is all getting into just different genes and proteins that pathology will identify in your specific breast cancer biopsy. In 2013, science started to further define different types of breast cancer in terms of some of you who are more recently diagnosed might be more familiar with hearing luminal A or luminal B breast cancer, or also triple negative basal cell like breast cancer. So there's subtypes even in between that, which gets really hard as a patient. I think what's most important for a patient to know about these
is to know what type of breast cancer you have, because treatments are targeted specifically on your hormonal type. So, for example, my breast cancer is ER positive, PR positive, HER2 negative, which is one of the most common subtypes of breast cancer. One thing that many people don't realize is that your breast cancer subtype can sometimes change as you go on with treatment. So if you do have metastatic breast cancer and treatment stops working, sometimes a new biopsy of that tissue is warranted, because you can go from an ER positive status to even a triple negative status, and that would determine your change in treatment. So we do know that there are about 150,000 to 250,000 women and men in the United States who are currently living with metastatic breast cancer. And men do get metastatic breast cancer. It's a large, large number of men and women. Breast cancer is the second largest killer of women in the United States, right after lung cancer. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that 30% of the people who have been diagnosed with breast cancer will eventually develop metastatic breast cancer. And what's hard about this is that once you've been diagnosed with breast cancer, the scary part and what we want to help you deal with today is that you could develop metastatic breast cancer anywhere from 1 to 20 years past your original diagnosis date. So that's why we feel, Camille and I feel today, it's really important to give you this knowledge and information to help you know what some of the warning signs are, to help you have some knowledge to protect yourself and keep you on a good course on this journey. Camille, are you there?
I'm sorry, I am here. In 2014, Pfizer Oncology did a study looking at people's attitudes towards metastatic breast cancer. And even among people outside of the breast cancer community and within the breast cancer community, more than 60% of respondents said they know little to nothing about metastatic breast cancer. We talked about the pronunciation of it. Some people don't even know the word or what it means. Part of the confusion is because it is so, it does go by so many names. We can call it stage 4 or terminal or incurable or advanced stage. They all mean the same thing. And metastatic right now is the term that most people within the metastatic community are using to describe it. Until very recently, many breast cancer organizations just didn't want to include information about METs, partly because it is complicated, it's depressing, it can be really, really scary for people who are worried about a recurrence. But just because it's frightening doesn't mean we should be silent about it. Many people living with metastatic breast cancer wish that we would have had more information about it prior to our metastatic diagnosis. Another reason I think why historically metastasis has been a little bit ignored is we don't necessarily fit into the survivor mold. We are not necessarily going, we can't overcome this disease. We'll definitely die from it. And so we're not in that category of people who can sort of go out and celebrate and be excited about beating breast cancer. And while that's a sad thing to talk about, it is our truth. In addition, the Pfizer survey said that 72% of people believe that advanced stage cancer is curable if it's diagnosed early, and that is untrue. I think maybe the messaging about catching early stage breast cancer in the early stages may have become mixed up with catching it in the advanced stages. Of course, if it is caught at stage one as opposed to stage three, there's less medical intervention. However, that does not improve overall survival. I wanted to kind of explain a little bit about that the mets will not go away. No doctor knows how to get rid of them. However, sometimes the metastasis will shrink enough through chemo and various hormonal treatments that it actually will become what's known as no evidence of disease, NED for short. And it's possible for somebody to have metastasis and say, I'm no evidence of disease. That just means the disease is small enough that it cannot be detected on a PET or CT scan. It doesn't mean that the cancer is still there. It doesn't mean that the cancer is gone. The cancer is still there. It just can't be seen. And the goal living with early stage breast cancer is, of course, to eliminate the breast cancer from the body and be cured. But the goal with metastatic breast cancer is to simply stop it from growing aggressively, and that's called stable disease. So part of living with metastasis is the whole psychological game of trying to learn how to live with, okay, I can't get rid of the cancer. It's going to be in my body forever. But if I can keep it stable with the proper medication, then I kind of think of it as being at a truce with the cancer where, you know, it needs me to be alive in order to live. The Pfizer study also went on to kind of talk a little bit about some of the attitudes about people who have metastasis. 50% of people believe that breast cancer progresses because the patient either didn't take the right treatment or the right preventative measures. And this is, of course, not true at all. But because of this attitude, when somebody is diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, it's very common to receive emails from friends with websites that have simple cures for cancer, you know, oh, if you eat enough pomegranates or if you eat enough asparagus or if you go to Mexico for a coffee enema, you can easily get rid of this disease. And unfortunately, none of those are supported by scientific research. I wish it were as easy as a trip to Mexico to cure the cancer. I'd gladly give up the chemo if that were true. But because so many people believe that it's our fault that we got metastasis, people with mets tend to feel a tremendous stigma within the breast cancer community. And in my case, I did everything my doctor said. So after my stage three cancer was cured, I went back to exercising 5 days a week. I never did drink alcohol or caffeine or eat red meat. And I still got mets. And the important thing to remember is doctors have no idea why it spreads, and they have no idea how to prevent metastasis. So I think it's one of my goals today is to just dispel some of that magical thinking. And unfortunately, this dose of reality is very difficult, I think, especially for people who have beaten their early stage disease, to kind of be told, oh, wait, it can come back even if I eliminate sugar, even if I do everything I think I need to do. And that means that we need to give up some amount of control, which is really, really difficult for anyone to give up control. So we've kind of dispelled some of the beliefs about the miracle cures that are out there on the internet. The things that really do work, though, are a ton of different treatments. These treatments All of the treatments that are on the slide right now, for those of you who have the slides, Zolota, tamoxifen, letrozole, fazodexin, letrozole, Afinitor, and the various doses, I've been on all of these. At the moment, I am on a clinical trial. I have the BRCA genetic mutation, so that's how I ended up with this. And I am doing very well on the medication that I'm on right now. But the problem is, so some people will say breast cancer is like a chronic condition where you just keep taking medication forever. And I bristle a little bit at the term chronic condition because to me, chronic condition implies we know how to control the condition and live with it. Unfortunately, comparing, for example, to diabetes, if somebody is diabetic and is insulin dependent, they know that the insulin will continue to work for a period of time. However, with all of these drugs that I have been on, I think the longest that any one of those has worked has been about 9 months for me, generally speaking. And some of these treatments can last years for some people. But generally speaking, these drugs are giving you, you know, several months of extended life as opposed to years. And the other reason this is different from a chronic condition is because we know that the cancer will continue to mutate and become drug resistant. And again, doctors don't understand how this happens. They're trying to make sense of it, but they haven't figured it out yet. And there are a lot of clinical trials going on. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But a question, when people hear that I have breast cancer, a lot of times they'll say, well, when are you going to be done with chemo? And in the early stages, you usually have a set date that you're done with chemo. But with metastatic breast cancer, I will be done with chemo when we run out of chemo options, once we've used all the drugs that are out there and there are no more left to use, or when I decide I don't want to do treatment anymore, and then at that point would go into hospice. So we stay alive only because of the drugs we're on, because without them, the cancer progresses very, very, very quickly. Judy, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, thank you, Camille. And I want to back up just a second because I forgot to say something that I meant to earlier. I do hope everybody understands in the webinar, Camille and I aren't doctors, so we're not offering medical advice to anybody, but this is our experience and our knowledge and what we know from what we're living with and going through. One of the things I think is most challenging being a metastatic breast cancer patient is when you do start a new treatment, you kind of have to figure out how your life is working again in terms of side effects. For example, I've progressed past being able to take all oral medication, which is easy in terms of I don't have to go into the clinic and get an IV infusion every week. It's just more convenient because I can swallow the pill at home. However, a lot of the oral medications are still chemotherapy and can have very significant side effects. So each time I start a new drug or treatment, I have to learn all over again how my body is responding to that so that I can start planning and working my life around it. In other words, right now I am on IV treatment. I get my treatments on Thursday. I know I'm kind of going to be able to function on Friday and Saturday, and Sunday is going to be my day on the couch or in bed. So I know how to plan appointments or what I'm doing for family fun and interaction. But each time I start a new treatment, I have to kind of go through figuring out that process again and reorganizing my life around those new side effects and symptoms. It's challenging. I think Camille and I both say that we're very grateful that we have so many drug options. There are some new drug options that have come out in the last couple of years, but there still aren't enough. I think both of us wish there were a lot more of additional drug options available. And it is, as Camille said, what happens is the cancer gets smarter and mutates and figures out a workaround in terms of the drug, and so we'll start growing again. And that kind of brings us to the next slide. And Camille, I'll let you start with that, and then I'll jump in too.
Thanks, Judy. So living with metastatic breast cancer, you get into this cycle that kind of rhymes. It's scan, treat, repeat. Scan, treat, repeat. And what happens is, because the cancer is mutating constantly, the way we figure that out is sometimes I will start to have a symptom. My metastasis is in my bones, so sometimes I will experience some pain in the spots where I have the mets, and I'll alert my doctor to it, or maybe it's just time for a scan, a regularly scheduled scan. Usually many patients have them every 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, depends on the protocol for the medication. So that scan will tell us, and it can be a PET, CT, MRI. Different doctors have different imaging that they like to look at. And then based on what that says, if it says the disease is stable, then that means we can stay on the same treatment that we've been on. It means it's working. But if the disease is progressing, that means then we know the drug has stopped working and it's time to start a new one. So then we're treated with that drug until the next scanning cycle. There's something called scanxiety, which is anxiety and scan put together. And it can be very stressful in the weeks and days before a scan, feeling like, well, what is it going to say? Has my disease progressed in a big way, or am I going to be okay? And then after the scan, waiting for the results can be stressful because it usually takes a few days to get those results. Judy alluded to new treatments are stressful. Pretty much most of the treatments I have been on, the main side effect has been fatigue, just not having the kind of energy that I once had. But then there's always a few other side effects that might have to do with mouth sores or tummy trouble or skin changes. And all of these side effects may mean needing medications to deal with those side effects. So it really makes planning for the future difficult. Judy, did you have anything else on screen treatment?
I think that covers it. I just like what you said. It gets really stressful because you know the ball is going to drop at some point. So with every scan, you're always wondering where you're going to be next. But we do learn how to deal with it. And we'll talk about some of those tools that you and I use later. So how close are we to a cure? 40,000 people die in the United States every single year from metastatic breast cancer. That's 113 people every single day. That's staggering. The average lifespan after diagnosis is 33 months, and that's a scary number, but I want people to realize that that's the average. So there's some people on the beginning of the tail who don't survive as long. However, there are many people on the other end of the tail who can survive 10 or even 13, 15 years with metastatic breast cancer. It gets to be a lower number, but Camille and I have both made it past that 33-month part, and we're really happy. I think many of you have probably seen controversy in the news regarding mammograms and early detection. And I think what's hard about that is as we get more and more able to diagnose smaller and smaller amounts of breast cancer, the question is, what is over-treatment with those diagnoses? And I think we still need to learn a lot about that. I had a mammogram, and still 3 months later, my breast cancer was discovered. So we'll see. I think in terms of needing a new direction to focus our awareness, what Camille and I are talking about there is, I think all of us now are aware of what breast cancer is, and are aware of doing self-exams and how important that is, I think now we need to turn our awareness into educating people about late-stage metastatic breast cancer and what we need to do in terms of research for that. And one of the reasons for that is because only 7% of the $15 billion that were invested in breast cancer research in the years 2000 to 2013 went towards specific metastatic breast cancer research. And that's kind of scary because I think, and even as an early stage breast cancer patient, I knew that kind of my only safety net was having more money going into metastatic breast cancer research because that is what would keep me alive in the future.
And these statistics about the funding being so low for the most deadly breast cancer are very shocking. And if you are encountering them for the first time, it might take you some time to digest, and I hope that you will sort of come back to this. Because the question is always, what can I do? And we have a couple of resources. There is an organization called MetaViver, and they are a nonprofit organization run by volunteers, and they put all they do is fund metastatic breast cancer research. So anything donated to them will go to metastatic breast cancer research. If you donate to another research organization, like the last slide said, it will be maybe a few pennies on the dollar donated to metastatic breast cancer research. There is also a great organization, Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance. They have also some really good information and about research. The Department of Defense, and I won't get into why it's the Department of Defense, but Congress gives them money each year to look at breast cancer research. And Judy and I are both reviewers. They're always looking for reviewers for that. And they do a terrific job of including consumers, individuals with metastasis in the process. We like to say think before you pink. If there is a product that you are buying that is pink and it doesn't necessarily say that any of the money is going to breast cancer research, I know when I'm in the store, I will bring that item to the store manager and say, I don't think you should carry this item anymore. But also think about all of the organizations that you work with and if they are sort of promoting breast cancer research, ask the question, what are you doing for metastasis? Because it's people asking that question over and over again that will make a difference. And I want to introduce you to maybe a term you haven't heard, and that is called fearless friends. These are people who are have early stage breast cancer or maybe have never had breast cancer, but they have made a decision to set their fear aside and be friends with people with metastasis. It is not easy being friends with people with metastasis because you know a lot of people who die, and that is obviously unpleasant. But we really need people who are early stagers to go up to bat for metastatic disease and more research and more understanding of it. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my story. This is an approximation, a photoshopped approximation of what I look like right now. Before stage 3 breast cancer, I had opposite color hair than what I have now. I was working full-time. My husband, Wade, was working full-time. We kind of tried to tag team it so we wouldn't have to have our kids in child care too much. My daughter, Vivian, if you're looking at the slides, was just starting first grade, and my son, Jackson, was just a little bit over 1 when I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. it was a tremendous shock. To begin with, I thought I was only going to need, I was told I would just need a lumpectomy, but once they got in there, they saw it was in my lymph nodes in stage 3, and then all of a sudden, I was going to need chemo and radiation as well. When I first started out, I just thought, I wasn't that scared. I kind of thought it was no big deal. But once I found out I needed chemo and radiation, that scared me. And obviously, I shaved my head before my hair could fall out. And then I found out that I had the BRCA genetic mutation. So that instructed my decision to have a hysterectomy and oophorectomy, removing the ovaries to prevent ovarian cancer, which I now knew I was at risk with, and went back and had a mastectomy with reconstruction. When I got done with all of that, I thought I have learned a lot. I'm much wiser now, but I get to go back to life as normal. I was getting my energy back, and then all of a sudden, I found out in 2012, so almost 5 years after my initial diagnosis, I found out that the cancer had metastasized to my bones. And the way I found that out was I had a pain in my hip that, despite physical therapy and seeing many, many doctors and having many x-rays and even having an MRI, the pain just got worse and worse and worse, despite how many pain pills I was taking, despite how many exercises I was doing or not doing. It just got worse. So finally, a doctor redid an MRI and discovered it was all over my bones. And needless to say, I really went through a grieving process through our early days with breast cancer, keep calm and carry on, became a mantra, because to me that represented not ignoring what was going on, but it represented, okay, take a deep breath and just keep moving forward with life. And having two small kids helped me to move forward with life. But once the metastasis happened, I didn't know much about metastasis. I can tell you by the end of this webinar, if you are an early stage person, you will know more about metastasis than I did going into the diagnosis. I thought that I was going to die right away. I had no idea what that meant. And I went through the grieving process. I had a lot to grieve. It wasn't very long after my diagnosis that I realized that being on chemo forever would mean not having the kind of energy that I once had. Unfortunately, I had to go on long-term disability from my job, which was emotionally very painful, was financially painful as well. But I really wasn't quite sure who I was. And eventually, I came upon these three questions that are from a psychologist who works in grief named John Schneider. And he says to ask three questions: what is lost, what is left, what is possible. And I was really clear on what was lost. I had lost my idea of myself as a healthy person. I had lost my assumption that I would live to be an old woman, I would live to see my children graduate high school and college and get married and all those things that we think about as parents. But when I saw these three questions, I started taking inventory of what is left, and I realized that there was a lot left of my life. I had a community of people supporting our family. I had two kids who I was still there to help them day to day with their own lives. I had a marriage that has certainly been through a lot, even before cancer had been through a lot, but that was solid. And I also still had my faith in God, although it was a very different faith in God than it was pre-cancer. And then the third question that this doctor asked people is, what is possible? So with what I've given up through what is lost, you know, I haven't chosen to give those things up, but now that those things are gone, with what's left, what's possible? And as I started asking those questions, I started listening to other people, and they started saying, you know, this blog that you have kept and the words that you've shared have been really helpful, and maybe you can share that with a wider audience. So I began to focus my effort on advocacy and helping people who are living with metastatic breast cancer to be able to live a better life. One thing that I had observed when I was looking for information was there weren't a lot of books. There weren't a lot of memoirs about people living with metastatic disease. And the memoirs that I did find about breast cancer, a lot of them are written by celebrities who didn't have the kind of worries that regular people have. And so eventually I sat down with a couple editors and sat down with a publisher and created the book Camp Chemo. And it really shows my day-to-day experience, stage three, and then getting the diagnosis of stage four. And it chronicles really my first almost 2 years of dealing with that diagnosis and how it really changed me and how I wrapped my head around it. I continue to be an advocate and am happy to speak with any group about my experience, because I think sometimes it can be difficult to find individuals with metastatic disease who are healthy enough to go out and talk, but also who are willing to do it, because not everybody wants to share their experience. So I'm happy to do that. And I'd like to give Judy a chance to tell you a little bit more about her story.
Thanks, Camille. I have been living with cancer a really long time. 20 years ago, when I was 33 and my youngest was 9 months old, I was diagnosed with chondrosarcoma, which is a cancer of the cartilage. It was in one of the bones of my leg. So you can see in the picture there with my son, who also had some special needs and a lot of health conditions at the same time, I had surgery to remove a section of that bone. I didn't have to have chemo or radiation at that time, so we recovered and moved on. But I remember always being worried about, what if that cancer came back? How could I deal with it? And I finally just one day said, I need to let this monkey off my back and let it go. And I did. But of course, about a month after that, in 2006, I found a lump in my breast, and I was diagnosed with stage one breast cancer. I had a mastectomy, went through chemo, did all of that, and thought, okay, things are going to be good. And it was at my five-year checkup that we recognize that sometimes a doctor, not all doctors do it, and this isn't a great test for everybody, but we would do tumor marker blood work tests, and that had doubled. And so he sent me for some scans, and we realized that the breast cancer had metastasized to my bones. I did not realize that if you did not have, that you could still get metastatic breast cancer, even if you didn't have anything in your lymph nodes. So the cancer can spread through your bloodstream, and that's what happened with me. So I started treatment, and just this last fall, got to lose my hair again for the second time. You get kind of used to it, and now it's in various stages of coming back. So how do I live with what I've been living with for the past 20 years? And for me, a lot of it is about finding balance. And I like doing yoga, and I kind of imagine it's like doing tree pose. Sometimes I'm going to fall and mess up and get mad, angry, scared out of my mind, depressed, worried, and not know how I'm going to go forward. And what I have to do is not judge myself, not judge how I'm doing or how well I'm doing, but I just have to get up and try again. And so that's what I do. And I just try to maintain that balance. The other thing that I've learned in my life is that when I start really freaking out, it's because I'm looking too far into the future. And when I start getting really depressed and sad, it's sometimes because I've looked too far into the past. What I really need to do is maintain my focus exactly on the present moment. And when I live in the present moment, I'm okay. I'm here today. I'm having a great day. It's a beautiful day outside. I had breakfast with both of my kids in one place at one time. And as they get older, some of you know how rare and fantastic that is to be able to do. So that's a really good piece of advice I have for everybody, whether you have cancer or not. We all have really hard things that happen in our lives. Everybody has hard things. And you can do hard things. You just have to figure out the tools for you that are going to work. And practice using those tools and forgive yourself when you don't do well and try again. So one of the things that I've also learned for me is when I do really feel extreme fear, if I can find one small thing to focus a sliver of gratitude on, it helps me to stop being afraid. And I don't mean that in a Pollyanna way. I have lived through some incredible things in my life besides just cancer. I've had a really crazy life. And I know that finding something to be grateful for helps me move past the fear. It refocuses me on what's important in my life and what I do have on my life, or in what I do have in my life to be thankful for. So try it. And it doesn't have to be a great thing to be grateful for. Sometimes, as I've said, when I'm laying in the mud staring at the dirt, if I find just one piece of green grass, one blade of grass, I can focus on that and be grateful that that is there. I just also want to remind everybody, I try and practice compassion. As I said, everybody has a hard battle and a hard thing that they're fighting, but really be kind because you don't know what everybody else is going through. And I really do love this saying that everyone you meet is fighting some kind of a hard battle. Camille and I want to share some of these resources with you. And I'm also looking at the time, and I know we want to leave time for people to be able to ask questions, and we want to answer some. So I'm not going to go over every one of these resources because I know that they will be posted on the BCEA page, and I think we'll cover some more information about that towards the end of the webinar also. So just so we have enough time, let's open it up to some questions for everybody.
And Judy and Camille, I know that you received some questions already, and so I'll let you go ahead and address those, and I will jump in when I get more on the screen. So anyone who is joining via webcast and has the ability to submit specific questions for Camille or Judy, please do so now.
Camille, do you want to take the first question?
I am just... Yes, so we have a question here about advances in treatment for stage four, and there is a really good resource for this. Well, the big resource for this is clinicaltrials.gov, and that site is it's huge because it's all the clinical trials, and you can filter it down a little bit to look for breast cancer. But if you go to Living Beyond Breast Cancer, you can go and you click on metastatic. I'm living with metastatic disease. Judy pointed out there's a picture of me on that page, so you can see me before I dyed my hair blonde. But that has... there is a metastatic trial search, and that is an organization, and there's a link right to the organization that is a way for you to be able to put in the details of your specific cancer, if it's estrogen positive or HER2 positive, and then they will alert you to, or you can just search on their site for studies that would relate to you. because sometimes it can be difficult to wade through clinicaltrials.gov. There are also, Living Beyond Breast Cancer will often do webinars like after the annual ASCO meeting, the meetings that they have in San Antonio and Chicago, and international meetings that have information about that to keep up to date.
Camille and Judy, I do have a couple questions, so I'll start with the first one, if you don't mind. And the first one is from Leslie, and she's wondering, how do you become an advocate?
That's a great question. I think the first thing is to look at some of the organizations that are out there, and if you can find one that fits with your values, really being an advocate can happen on many different levels. It can be a self-advocate where you are speaking up at your doctor's appointment. Just yesterday at my doctor's appointment, I spoke up to the scheduler who said, you need this drug every 3 weeks. And I said, I thought I heard the doctor say I needed it every 2 weeks. And so the scheduler was able to call the doctor and, yep, I need it every 2 weeks. So there's self-advocacy, and then there's like media advocacy, which I do with my book, but then there's even legislative advocacy. So there's so many different kinds. So if there's an organization that is doing the work that you believe in doing, it's really going to work for that organization and helping them find the funding or the recognition or whatever it is that they need. Judy, do you have anything to add? You've been doing this a long time too.
Yep, I do. And I think another great place is listed in the resources. Many of the places that Camille is mentioning will be there for you to be able to find. But the Living Beyond Breast Cancer, they do a advocacy training every year in the fall if you attend that conference. And they have scholarship opportunities and things like that. I think Camille mentioned briefly community advocacy, and that's one of the things that I've done with Team Judy. We wanted to fund research that was local, and we have this phenomenal national cancer recognized institute and the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota. So that's one of the things that we did, is helping to fund research for them. And you can call them and do that if that's something that is exciting to you and you're passionate about. And you can email me and I can give you ideas on how to do that. I think also, it's like Camille said, there's just self-advocacy and signing up for this webinar. Now you have more information about metastatic breast cancer that you can go out and start sharing and educating with other people. So do we have another question too?
We do, and this is directed at Camille. The question was, did your bone pain involve muscle spasm or muscle pain, and did it wax and wane, and would it get better and worse?
Yeah, it did wax and wane. I think that I eventually started having some muscle pain just because I was favoring one side so much. I was walking with a pretty pronounced limp and needed crutches mm-hmm. by the end. And, yeah, it did come and go. And one of the things, you know, doctors know a lot, but they only know what they know. And one thing that I kept being asked was, well, what time of day are you having the pain? And for me, it was worse at night. And I was reassured by many people, oh, well, that's a good sign because cancer pain can be worse in the morning. And, you know, I haven't kind of gone back to ask questions about why I was told that or you know, if I was just such a rare percentage that had pain that was worse after I laid down at bedtime. But yeah, it came and went. And I hate to scare people, but there are – I think it's very difficult sometimes for doctors to find metastatic breast cancer on a scan. So my advice to people is just if the pain cannot be explained any other way, or if you're getting – I was told I had bulging discs and degenerative disc disease, and they thought it was referred pain coming from my spine, but that just seemed – it didn't seem logical to me. You know, just keep asking for imaging every few months, and because mine didn't show up in the first imaging that they did. It you know, took a while for it to be big enough to actually show up on the imaging. So, and that's a big problem, is diagnosis for metastasis, but that's a topic for another day. Hope
can
that helps.
Can I add just a short bit there? Because I have, I don't have organ involvement right now, but I do have mets up and down my spine and ribs and kind of all over some other areas of my body. And I think it's important, if you're seeing a general practitioner or somebody like that, sometimes you have to remind them that you have had breast cancer. Because I really feel that a relationship with your doctor, it's teamwork. You can't put all that responsibility on the medical profession. You have to work with them too. You're in this together. So my second piece of advice is really trust yourself and listen to your body. And if you have something that you feel is just truly not right and it's persistent and it's still bothering you, then be persistent, like Camille said, and keep asking for somebody to check it out. And if you're in a not great relationship with a medical professional, go somewhere else. You have a right to a second opinion. And if you have a doctor that's kind of up in arms over the mention of a second opinion, I always say run and go find somebody else who agrees that second opinions are important, because that's a doctor that you can really work with, because it needs to be a collaboration and a team.
Well, I think we're pretty close to the top of the hour again, so I just want to sincerely thank our outstanding presenters, Camille Scheel and Judy Erdahl, and to everyone for joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and don't forget to join us for the next webinar on August 23rd and at our annual conference on October 8th.